nuclear radiation, resulting illnesses, and rights. To understand the dangers of radiation and what we all face from exposure, it's important to understand the past and take action for the future. The past is often best explained through films that parse the information and lay out the issues in a clear, concise way. The future will be created by actions that we take in response to that information. So when you hear from two powerful activists on the radiation exposure timeline, and first, someone who has been on the front lines of nuclear test fallout in the American West for generations, and he tells you,
consider, are we heading in the right direction as a species? As a species, because these weapons of war are leading us to a tipping point against our environment, and we need to be aware that we're all at risk, we're all downwind, and radiation does not discriminate, so we all need to look at this and be aware.
And then someone who has been exposed to the radioactive waste and fallout from the Manhattan Project to build the bomb goes to Congress to push for the extension and expansion of the one governmental program that provides support to victims of radiation from our nuclear programs. And she tells you,
the program ends June 7th. That doesn't mean it completely goes dark. It means, you know, there might be some money in there to go a few extra weeks. Not enough. How about that? Not enough time to do it. But considering everything and how far we've gotten it so far, passed twice in the Senate, we didn't have enough time for that, and we did it. So I'm still feeling very optimistic. I think our support grows every day.
Well, when Ian Zabarte, principal man of the Western Tribes of the Shoshone Nations, and Dawn Chapman, one of the founders of Just Moms STL, St. Louis, about concerned citizens in North St. Louis and their supporters who are fighting for extension and expansion of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which is meant to help those whose lives and health have been negatively impacted by radioactive Manhattan Project bomb manufacturing waste, you get a really clear picture of the range of dangers, issues, and challenges facing those of us who know too well about that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a series of interviews to catch up on a series of stories. We'll hear first from Dawn Chapman, who right now, as I am recording this, is in Washington, D.C., meeting with members of the House of Representatives. She is there with others from downwinder communities around the country to put a human face on the struggle to get Congress to expand and extend the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. We'll also hear from Ian Zabarte, principal man for the Western Bands of the Shoshone Nation, who produced the Las Vegas edition of the International Uranium Film Festival and has much to say about the importance of the films shown in laying out the issues created by the nuclear industry and actions taken to try to rein them in. Norbert Sukhanek, co-founder and co-director of the International Uranium Film Festival, we'll also have a few words on the closing of the two-month monumental U.S. tour and advance word of when the festival is returning to the United States. And we will also have a few archival words from powerhouse activist Patty Amino, who passed away this past week from multiple cancers. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, John LaForge with the Nuke Watch Report, and more honest nuclear information than was explored by the media during the recent massive solar flares. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 14, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. The Nuclear Notebook, a report researched and written by the staff of the Federation of American Scientists Nuclear Information Project, is being disseminated by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which is a long way of saying this is a report on United States Nuclear Weapons 2024. It reports that in May 2024, the U.S. Department of Defense maintained an estimated stockpile of approximately 3,708 nuclear warheads for delivery by ballistic missiles and aircraft. Most of these weapons are stored for potential upload onto missiles and aircraft as necessary. The report estimates that approximately 1,770 warheads are currently deployed, of which roughly 1,370 strategic warheads are deployed on ballistic missiles, and another 300 at strategic bomber bases in the United States. An additional 100 tactical bombs are deployed at air bases in Europe. Everything else, just under 2,000 of them, are in storage as a so-called hedge against technical or geopolitical surprises. Consider that each of these bombs is more powerful, far more powerful, than the ones dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and it makes one wonder why we are rushing to create more plutonium pits, to create more bombs, when what we already have in stock is powerful enough to, and here I use the technical term, blow us all to kingdom come. We will link to where you can find a copy of this report yourself and see where taxpayer money that should be going to cover things like health care, education, and necessary infrastructure is actually going. Also from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, spent nuclear fuel mismanagement poses a major threat to the United States. Irradiated fuel assemblies, essentially bundles of fuel rods that have been removed from a nuclear reactor, otherwise referred to as spent fuel, generate a great deal of heat from the radioactive decay of the nuclear fuel's unstable fission products. That's a fancy way of saying this stuff is so hot and radioactive, it must be submerged in circulating water in a storage pool for years and years and years before it can possibly be moved on to a different form of storage. But this spent fuel can also overheat and burn in the storage pool if coolant water is lost, thereby releasing large amounts of radioactive material into the air. Spent fuel pools at U.S. nuclear plants are almost as densely packed with nuclear fuel as operating reactors, a hazard that has existed for decades and vastly increases the odds of having a major accident. Moving on with the good news, Nuclear Watch New Mexico has released a series of maps showing radiation contamination at thousands of sites miles from the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Plutonium hotspots appear along tribal lands, hiking trails, city streets, and the Rio Grande River. We will link to that series of maps at Nuke Watch New Mexico. We'll have it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 673. Now, here is the monthly Nuke Watch report with Nuke Watch co-founder and co-director John LaForge.
In Minnesota, 2 hours upwind from our Nuke Watch office is the 53-year-old Monticello nuclear reactor on the Mississippi River. Xcel Energy, the owner, has applied for a license extension for the Jalopy, which is a General Electric clone of the same age and design as the three catastrophically melted down but permanently radioactive waste generators at Fukushima in Japan. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, has issued a long Environmental Impact Statement, EIS for short, to promote the relicensing. The report ignores climate change threats to the reactor and trivializes a recent radioactive leak that has plagued the Mississippi River and Xcel's public image. Public comments on the EIS are being taken until June 10th. A lot of writers are demanding that the deadline be extended in view of the gravity of the decision. Xcel already won an extension allowing the reactor to run for 60 years. A second renewal would it allow it to risk disaster for 80 years, 40 years beyond its original design life. Sadly, the review process is a sort of charade because the NRC has approved 87 out of 92 such applications. Xcel's reactor endangers 3.7 million people in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area and another 20 million people downstream who rely on the Mississippi for drinking water. The NRC's environmental impact statement barely mentions the Great River as a major source of drinking water, noting only that the waterworks intake is 37 miles downstream. This drinking water is the principal matter of fact regarding Monticello's environmental impact. The issue is such an Achilles heel for Xcel and the NRC that the public has been treated to a stream of lies that disguise or hide the facts. The reactor has caused a string of radioactive releases to the Mississippi, most recently an 8,829,000 gallon leak of reactor cooling water, highly contaminated with radioactive tritium, xenon, and iodine. The leak occurred from late 2022 through early 2023, creating a plume of radioactive groundwater, which, according to the EIS itself, likely discharged to the river. Xcel and the NRC kept this leak hush-hush for 4 months while Xcel made its application to the NRC for the 80-year operating license. The concentration of tritium in that leak was 250 times what's allowed in drinking water by the Environmental Protection Agency. Tritium, the radioactive form of hydrogen, permanently contaminates gigantic volumes of any water that it touches. Tritium then stays in the environment for 123 years. On March 18, 2023, NRC spokesperson Victoria Mittling told the press, quote, "There is no pathway for the tritium to get into drinking water," end quote. This shocking disinformation is contradicted by Xcel's own annual radioactive effluent release report, which says, quote, "There are several mechanisms that can result in doses to the public, including ingestion of radionuclides in water," end quote. Victoria Mittling's lying was committed about 1 year before the NRC's own EIS would conclude, quote, "Tritium impacted groundwater likely discharged to the river," end quote. Chris Clark, Xcel's president, told the Associated Press last year, even if the tritium reached the river, quote, "it would dissipate within a few yards," end quote. Mr. Clark used some compound lying here, saying tritium would not reach the river was false, and using the word dissipate, which means to disappear, was a lie, while Mr. Clark knows full well that tritium persists in the environment for over a century. Xcel's tritium in the drinking water may become diluted, but all the tritium stays in the river as it moves downstream. It may be consumed in mere trace amounts, but tritium crosses the placenta and can cause problems with pregnancies and birth abnormalities. Indeed, the NRC and Xcel know that the harmful effects of radiation are particularly dangerous to women, girls, and to fetuses. At a Monticello public hearing May 8th, the NRC's Jason Reed dared to say, quote, "Even if the whole leak had gone into the Mississippi, it wouldn't create a health threat," end quote. This flabbergasting dishonesty is debunked by the NRC's own fact sheet, known as Radiation Exposure and Cancer, which says on the website, "Any amount of radiation may pose some risk for cancer and hereditary effect. Any increase in dose, no matter how small, results in an incremental increase in risk," end quote. Even the underground steel wall that Xcel pounded into the soil between the reactor and the Mississippi River last August wasn't built to keep tritium out of the river. The EIS says it will, quote, "minimize discharges of tritium to the Mississippi," end quote. The wall is just a public relations prop, a stunt, a distraction, and a lie, like the bad horror show it is, but in this case, with radiation. With NukeWatch in Wisconsin, this has been John LaForge for Nuclear Hot Seat.
The thing about radioactive nuclear waste is that you can't throw it away because there's no such thing as a way, no matter how hard the powers that be try. The Atomic Energy Commission has a map that shows that between 1946 and 1970, More than 56,000 barrels of radioactive waste were dumped on the U.S. end of the Pacific Ocean. Now, these barrels are showing up, still full of waste, off the coast of Los Angeles. There is a notorious graveyard of discarded barrels off the coast of L.A. that are half sucked into the seafloor. And now scientists believe they contain not only toxic chemicals, but radioactive isotopes of tritium and carbon-14 as well. This goes along with old grainy black and white footage of sailors dumping barrels with radioactivity symbols on the outside of that into the ocean from fast-moving ships. Marine radiochemist Ken Buesler of the Woods Hole Institute, who is not involved in the study, says that these are still grim findings. He recently said, "The problem with the oceans as a dumping solution is that once it's there, you can't go back and get it. These 56,000 barrels, for example, we're never going to get them back." Which, of course, raises the question of the amount of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima that Japan is so blithely dumping into the Pacific Ocean month after month after month. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
The Idaho National Laboratory has announced plans to build two new nuclear reactors and one reactor experiment at its facilities in the desert of eastern Idaho. One of these projects is cunningly named Microreactor Applications Research Validation and Evaluation, with the acronym of MARVEL, just like the comic books. Who gets paid to come up with these things? San Onofre Nuclear Generating Group, songs, now we've got MARVEL, which upon closer examination isn't sounding very marvelous. The story I read is straight PR propaganda, repeatedly calling what will be generated carbon-free electricity, which is a lie when you look at the entire nuclear fuel chain and see that it is lousy with carbon, or clean energy. See the previous explanation. Meanwhile, this marvel, put that in quotes, of a reactor is expected to produce enough electricity to power, wait for it, 10 homes. That's right, one nuke can power 10 homes. Are they serious? And for those of us attuned to the subtleties of languaging, note that nowhere in this technology, at least based on this particular article, is the technology referred to as an SMR for small modular reactor, let alone SMNR for small modular nuclear reactor, putting in the other and oft avoided N word. Why is this significant? Languaging counts, and the term SMR has been terminally besmirched by its association with NuScale, the company which called itself global leaders in SMR nuclear technology. Or at least it did before it lost the only contract it ever had with Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems as being too expensive and too slow. As a result, NuScale stock value tanked, and nobody wants their technology to be tarred with the SMR failure brush. So the industry, in its wisdom, another term to be put in quotes, immediately responded, I mean like within 2 weeks, with a rebranding message. All references to the technology avoid SMR and are now geared to promoting advanced reactors, next generation reactors, microreactors, and the like. Not a failure-tainted acronym among them. Meanwhile, Idaho National Labs is still planning to go ahead with its new builds, which this program predicts will be late, over budget, and may never be finished in light of recent findings by Mark Jacobson, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. Jacobson has been carefully tracking supply and demand fluctuations on California's grid for the past 2 months and discovered that, according to data shared publicly on the California Independent System Operator's website, as of April 30th, during the previous 52 days, wind, water, and solar power have accounted for an average of 61.5% of the state's electricity demands. 44 of those days saw renewable energy sources, genuinely renewable carbon-free sources, meet or exceed 100% of the state's demand for at least 15 minutes. And the weekend of April 27 and 28 saw wind, water, and solar power covering California's energy demand for 9 hours and 45 minutes, a new record for the state. So we don't need new nukes, small, medium, any size in between. And that's why, to the dim bulbs behind this comic book marvel of an unreliable, too expensive, unreliable, and dangerously contaminating nuclear energy, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Over to Japan, where words matter. Foreign Minister Yoko Kamikawa reacted angrily to U.S. congressional testimony that appeared to validate the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speaking at the May 10 session of the Lower House Foreign Affairs Committee, Kamikawa said that the remarks, quote, were inappropriate and totally unacceptable. The matter stemmed from a May 8 session of the U.S. Senate Appropriations Committee, where the topic concerned a possible delay in providing weapons to Israel. Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, asked General Charles O. Brown, Jr., chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, quote, would you have supported the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II? Brown seemed stumped by the question, so Graham followed up by asking, in hindsight, do you think it was the right decision for America to drop two atomic bombs on the Japanese? To which Brown replied, I'll say, it stopped a world war. Actually, there were many factors that contributed to the stopping of World War II, including the threat posed by Russia's imminent invasion of Mongolia and beyond that, Japan, to try and grab land. Japan was terrified of having to deal with the Russians. So surrender was probably not that far off. Yet, Lindsey Graham asked the same question of U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who replied, I agree with the chairman. In response, Kamikawa was asked about the exchange at the U.S. Senate committee session, and she stated, we cannot accept having Senator Graham bring up the topic of the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki while the discussion was about the current situation in the Middle East. She went on to say, the use of nuclear weapons does not fit the spirit of humanitarianism that is the ideological foundation for international law because of the tremendous destructive capability and lethal force of such weapons. An article by Mia Winther Tamaki, Recovery of the State or Recovery of the People, is being sent around by Beyond Nuclear International, and it poses an interesting question. The Japanese people and landscapes still feel the unending impacts of a nuclear catastrophe that occurred a dozen years ago. Thousands of black bags litter the Fukushima exclusion zone, enclosing radioactive earth and rubbish with nowhere to go. Japan has begun releasing millions of tons of radioactive wastewater into the sea. The death and destruction of the earthquake and tsunami, a tragedy in itself, was compounded by nuclear calamity. Following the nuclear disaster, Japan shifted to a necessary post-disaster survival and recovery strategy that can be characterized by the term resilience. The ability to resist, absorb, accommodate to, and recover from the effects of a hazard in a timely and efficient manner. However, resilience was invoked and experienced in two distinct forms in the aftermath of Fukushima: recovery of the state and recovery of the people. It's a fascinating and astute distinction to have made, and we will link to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 673. Internationally, senior U.S. State Department arms control official Paul Dean urged China and Russia to match declarations by the United States and others that only humans and never artificial intelligence would make decisions on deploying nuclear weapons. Dean stated, "We would welcome a similar statement by China and the Russian Federation." And Rolls-Royce has scaled back plans to build nuclear factories in the UK, abandoning plans for one factory entirely because of delays in a UK government design competition for the small modular nuclear reactors. We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment, but first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares and revelations of old nightmares. But you couldn't tell any of this was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give a caring, compassionate, and concerned person such as yourself nuclear news you can count on. We are coming up on the 13th anniversary of the start of Nuclear Hot Seat. That's right, 13 full years of presenting 1 hour of nuclear information from a different perspective every week. As of today, that's 673 episodes and counting. Nuclear Hot Seat is the world's longest-running program that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. As both a podcast and, through Pacifica, a syndicated broadcast, we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear stories, giving context and continuity to local, national, and international stories. And we also work behind the scenes, providing introductions and contacts between activists, researchers, and reporters so that the honest nuclear story gets out far beyond this show. But in order to keep doing this work, we need your help. Yes, you sitting right there. This show runs on donations, and we are really in need of your support. Any amount helps, be it $5, the same as one would pay here in the States for a cup of coffee and a nice tip to the barista, or more. And you can set up a monthly recurring donation of any amount. It all counts towards our monthly nut. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means your donations are tax deductible. So just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here are this week's featured interviews. Some weeks, it's important to catch up on as many stories as possible, so what we have is a series of brief interviews on a number of topics. First, the informational meetings between representatives of radiation-impacted communities across the country with members of the House of Representatives about expanding and extending the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. This program provides nominal payments to help with health care for those whose lives and health have been negatively impacted by government-created radiation exposure. But RECA is set to expire on June 7, only 3 weeks from now. Meetings with congressional representatives are going on even as I record this. Last night, to find out more, I spoke with Dawn Chapman, co-founder of Just Moms STL, the group raising awareness of World War II Manhattan Project radioactive atomic weapons waste, which was dumped into Coldwater Creek in North St. Louis, and which has contaminated water, land, homes, and children. I spoke with Dawn Chapman on Tuesday, May 14, 2024. Dawn Chapman, we are now running right up against the line with getting RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, expanded and extended. What have been your activities in the most recent past? What's happening now?
For the past 2 weeks, the goal for getting RECA passed is to get in front somehow, even a hallway meeting, right, with Speaker Mike Johnson and figure out when, if, how he's going to put this up for a vote on the House floor while simultaneously whipping, right, the votes, making sure that in the event it hits the floor, we have enough. We want more than enough.
And it seems that at least this week, Speaker Johnson has another agenda, having just seen him in New York speaking outside of the trial of Donald Trump. What is your response to that?
My response is it feels like he just hopped a plane to Maui. I mean, he just kind of left town in the middle of a work week. There's agendas, there's committees, there's stuff going on. That's why we are going up there this week. This was the week that no big bills are going through, right? So we thought, well, this is a very considerate time for us to go and try and have a meeting with him. Surely his schedule is clear. Yeah, so it was kind of a slap in the face, and we all just kind of feel a little beat down over it, I would say.
Are you still planning on going to DC for lobbying? And if so, when is that going to happen?
The St. Louis group will travel very early in the morning to get there, and we'll land, and we won't check into our hotel till late in the evening. We go straight to the Hill and just meeting after meeting. You know, you're trying to fit as many conversations, moments into a short period that is their day, right? But our community members out west from Arizona, New Mexico, some from Utah, they're further away, so they require that extra day of travel. So they are already in DC, so we're going to meet up tomorrow morning, and we have a full day. I think there's about it looked to be about anywhere from 12 to 15 meetings, and we will all split up, right? But we will all make sure that if it is our state, we're in that meeting.
What position has Josh Hawley continued to have as regards working towards passage of RICA?
I gotta tell you, Senator Hawley's throwing everything he has at this, and then he's finding odd random objects off to the side and picking them up and throwing them too. I mean, anything he can do to get this across the finish line, he really is the champion. And I keep saying this, what we really need is a champion like him to match that energy in the House. That would really help. So the goal tomorrow is to emerge at the end of the day with a champion.
How much longer do you have?
You know, that's a really loaded question, but I'll just be completely honest. I mean, the program ends June 7th. That doesn't mean it completely goes dark. It means, you know, there might be some money in there to go a few extra weeks. Not enough. How about that? Not enough time to do it. But considering everything and how far we've gotten it so far, passed twice in the Senate, we didn't have enough time for that, and we did it. So I'm still feeling very optimistic. I think our support grows every day.
What has been the response to those members of the House who have been lobbied by you and the others from the various groups going to DC?
That's a great question. I'll tell you, I think that so we don't even call it lobbying. We go in and educate. Our thing is to really bring a personal face to this and to show the personal impact. And also we have the documentation, right? We bring our receipts, we bring our documents, we bring what proof that we have been exposed and to how much. But we also show them what does a community look like that's been put through what we've all been put through. And the unique thing is that for a group that's working together from across the United States, we all mesh so well because our stories are the same, right? I mean, radiation harms the same way and it doesn't discriminate. And so, what I'm seeing in my community, I know that my friend Mary from Utah is seeing in hers, you know? And so, it's effortless how we kind of pass the ball around the table. And it's just like one big dining room conversation, if you will. It's pretty casual. Pretty heartbreaking, but pretty moving, and I think that is what has moved the needle.
If this would come to vote, do you believe that you have the votes available to pass it and the only obstruction right now is Mike Johnson?
I do. I think we have the votes, and I'll tell you this, you know, we put them into categories, those that really support this, right? And I'm like, oh my goodness, this has to pass. Those that are like, yeah, that's pretty awful. And yeah, we need to do this. And those that are like, oh, that's awful, but it's expensive. Those are the iffy ones. But what we saw in the Senate is what's going to happen on the House floor, which is they're not going to vote no. They're going to be out in the open. Their community's impacted. You know, it's almost like we dare you to vote no.
So, what is it going to take that we, the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat, can do to up the amps on Mike Johnson if he is indeed the obstruction and get him to move off his derriere on this?
Do I have time for a little story about how to do that real quick? Because I got reminded of something the other day. So one of our House members made a great comment in the press, and I don't know him very well. I'm not his constituent, but he's in my state, Rep. Jason Smith. And I called his office because I thought, boy, that's a fantastic comment. I'm just going to thank them because, wow, on Rica, right? And the lady said, oh my gosh, thank you for not cussing me out. And also, oh my gosh, you're complimenting us and you're just talking. And so she really stayed on the phone and talked. And I said, I'm not his constituent, but he is from my state. This happened, this comment. And I think that do not ever underestimate the power of you just picking up the phone and calling an office saying, I'm really concerned about this issue. And I think you need to pay attention, whether it's to yours or to another person's. Because I think that those phone calls, I think they do matter. I really do.
We're going to post a link on Nuclear Hot Seat under this episode that will allow anyone to find out the phone number of their representative and how they can contact the office so that they can jump on this and help this move forward while we still have our chance.
Because of how these communities are and how long they've been contaminated, right? And then from all the way back to the Trinity test, Oppenheimer, and the above ground testing, and our situation, which is the processing from the 1940s, we are very confident that every congressional rep has at least one person, maybe two in their district, that either knows somebody or has been impacted that will benefit from this program. And I think that that's what we're seeing is kind of waking these people up. Even if they're a House rep that doesn't live next to an area, when we show them the above ground testing, right? And the map, and we also show them how long it's been, and they kind of look around and they're like, okay, yes, that there is a very good chance that we have people in our state that have been impacted, that moved. The other thing is that it is just so darn appalling what the federal government allowed to happen. And the Oppenheimer movie, on top of that, highlighting all this, I think it both intrigues and horrifies. And that is what I think compels a lot of Rika support.
We will be part of this battle alongside you and joining in and helping in whatever way we can. Dawn Chapman, tomorrow, you and all the others, go get them. And if there's anything else that people need to know, let me know and it will be on Nuclear Hot Seat. You always have a place on this show.
I will. I would say the one other thing that I would just tell your listeners that we're learning. I think this is what's so scary about it. And I think so many people are sitting back, coming to the realization. The science that they have as far as what you can be exposed to doesn't make sense. There are so many sick people. This radioactivity really hurts people. And I think at very low levels. And I think that almost the chronic exposure at the lower levels can be sometimes even more devastating. And I think that that's the fear. Because when you look at these communities and you look at us all standing next to each other, it's pretty horrific what's happening. And then what continues to happen after somebody's been exposed even 50 years ago to their children and grandchildren. It's just horrible.
Gratitude to you and the others for standing up as ferociously and as steadfastly as you have been. And as I said, anything we can do to support you in this, especially as we are coming down to a wire, maybe not the ultimate wire, but at least this one for now, let us know. It will be part of the show and we'll do what we can.
Thank you, Libby.
Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL. We'll post links to where you can find out who your congressional representative is and how to contact their office to speak with them on behalf of passage of RECA. That will be under Nuclear Hot Seat episode number 673. Ian Zabarte is principal man for the Western Bands of the Shoshone Nation and producer of the Las Vegas edition of the International Uranium Film Festival. He had this to say about the festival, its films, and his participation in it. Ian Zabarte, you have been the linchpin of this final presentation of the North American tour of the International Uranium Film Festival. 13 cities, 10,000 miles, 2 months, and here we are on the final day of the festival in Las Vegas, which you have made happen. What has it been like for you to pull this together and see the fruits of your efforts?
It's been exciting to be part of the film festival because this is more of a global issue, and the film festival brings a global audience and attention globally, and that's what's really important. And nationally, I think it's not unlike doing walks across America or other kinds of caravans into Washington, but this one I think is important as a way to reward or bring people together and enjoy the films and enjoy the city of Las Vegas. And sometimes we need to decompress, you know, and sit back. But once you've seen these films, you can go away with a better understanding and then look at everything around us and consider, are we heading in the right direction as a species? As a species, because these weapons of war are leading us to a tipping point against our environment. And we need to be aware that we're all at risk, we're all downwind, and radiation does not discriminate. So we all need to look at this and be aware.
Would you do this again?
Oh, yeah. Sure, I'll do it again. I can do better next time. The difficulty we had was not enough funding because it takes time. And I only had about 4 months to put this together. I didn't have a good chance to do outreach to other media outlets, and we're not like the big film festivals that spend millions of dollars and buying the media. Here, it's more of the passion of the filmmakers, and it's a good way to become aware of and increase our capacity of understanding what the nuclear issues and threats are.
If someone who's listening to this happens to be interested in bringing the International Uranium Film Festival to their hometown or target city or college campus or whatever it turns out to be, what would you say to them if they're thinking about it and they're on the fence and going, I don't know if I'm going to do this or not?
Well, for me, it's not about money. It's not about making money or trying to sell tickets. You know, I noticed that on the uraniumfilmfestival.org. Many of the festivals are free and open to the public. And so that's what we're striving for, is to make it free, create awareness. And, you know, I bought a very good theater here in Las Vegas, the Beverly Theater, because I felt it was important to provide the best cinema for the art of the filmmakers and watch their film on the big screen. But you can do it in a library, you can do it in a home setting for much cheaper than buying a theater. But this is really a great place to see these films on the big screen, because you're really not going to see these types of films on the big screen. So that's what we brought to Las Vegas, the film festival.
And if someone somewhere else is thinking about possibly bringing the festival to their hometown, do you think they should do it?
Yeah, of course, but you have to be a little more serious about doing that, because the film festival is a burden to bring for the organizers of the film festival, and there's only so many cities that they can attend, and you know, this tour has been thousands of miles, maybe 10,000 miles for the film festival organizers, so bear that in mind, be serious, and contact them early and plan well.
That was Ian Zabarte, principal man for the Western bands of the Shoshone Nation and producer of the Las Vegas edition of the International Uranium Film Festival. Shelley Berkley has served in Congress and is now running for mayor of Las Vegas. She was the only Nevada-based politician who chose to attend the festival and who has closely aligned herself with issues regarding the proposed nuclear waste site at Yucca Mountain. Here's what she had to say.
I'm here at the International Uranium Film Festival in Las Vegas, and I'm talking with Shelley Berkley, who is a candidate for mayor of Las Vegas this year and has come to attend the festival. What brought you here?
Well, I was invited to do the opening remarks. So at 3 o'clock, I'm going to welcome everybody and talk about the importance of this issue. When I was a United States Congresswoman representing this area, of course, primarily we were concerned with stopping nuclear waste being dumped in Yucca Mountain. And so many people don't realize, even years later, it was a purely political decision to locate the National Nuclear Repository here at Yucca Mountain, 90 miles from one of the largest tourist destinations in the world. It was a bad idea then, it's a bad idea now, and we need to do everything we can to stop it.
What, if any, power will you have as mayor of Las Vegas, projecting this forward, to make changes or exert pressure to get others to make changes?
Well, you would have to work with the congressional delegation. And, of course, I know them all very well, having once been one. So it's working with them to give them the strength and authority to continue the fight on behalf of all of our constituents. But that would be on the federal level. The beauty about being mayor of Las Vegas is you have a bully pulpit. So while nuclear waste is probably not within the job description of the mayor of Las Vegas, the fact is, A, I know the issue very well, having served for 7 terms in Congress, but B, I know how to use the bully pulpit and to get people engaged in this. And frankly, over the last few years, everyone has been fairly silent. It hasn't been on the front page of all of our newspapers, so people forget it, and there are other issues that occupy people's minds. But the fact is, this is important, and we need to do everything we can to ensure that our federal officials continue to stand up and say no on nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain. It's not the right location.
And are you familiar with the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act and the current push to get it passed by the House of Representatives in this term of Congress?
Yes. Well, I understand that it sunsets on June 4th of this year. So it's very important that not only does the legislation get extended, but I would like to see cities like Las Vegas that were excluded, Phoenix, and Salt Lake incorporated into the legislation. Now, whether that's going to happen, I don't know. But first, it's got to be reauthorized. Second, it's got to include other cities that could be considered as downwinders.
I look forward to hearing your further plans to assist in this push towards what can pass for nuclear sanity. And you've got my vote.
Well, thank you very much. This was a very worthwhile podcast for me, Ben.
Las Vegas mayoral candidate, Shelley Berkeley. The International Uranium Film Festival spent 2 months touring North America, going from Window Rock in Navajo Nation down to Texas, up the East Coast, over to Chicago, the West Coast, even Vancouver, British Columbia, before ending its marathon 13-venue, 10,000-mile journey in Las Vegas. Here's the festival's co-founder and director, Norbert Suchanek, giving perspective not only on what was, but the next set of plans for the IUFF.
I'm talking with Norbert Suchanek on May 2nd, 2024, which is the day after the close of the monumental 13-city, 2-month, 10,000-mile journey around North America, into Canada, and all over the U.S. with the International Uranium Film Festival. Norbert, how you holding up?
I'm very fine. And Marcia, too.
How do you keep going physically in addition to the emotional and spiritual commitment that you make to this?
That's a very tough question. But I think it's because we get the energy from the audience and from the filmmakers who show up. This really gives us the mental strength to continue. The physical strengths are, I think we have it from the beach of Ipanema,
which is a little ways away from the desert of Las Vegas.
Yes, but at the next week, we are back in Rio de Janeiro, and we are going back to our normal lifestyle. And so we will see the beach every morning, and we'll have our exercises over there, our little swim, and gives us the power to continue.
Having been at so many venues around the country, what stands out for you in your experience here in the U.S. and into Canada?
It's the networking, you know, 13 cities, and in every city we had different local organizers. And I think it's the first time in history that we could join the Veterans for Peace with Physicians for Social Responsibility from mostly all of the states, together with more than 24 other groups working on the issue of nuclear power. They have never been worked together before. And I think this is what is the most outstanding result of our festival.
What's next for the festival? Where will it next be showing up?
Well, we have, of course, our festival in Rio de Janeiro. It starts May 25. And we are going to show about 20 films during one whole week. And then we are still have in the planning to return to USA this year, even this year already, because we are planning to make the second film festival in Los Angeles, Hollywood, in November this year.
We will, of course, be looking forward to seeing you there. Now, looking forward to next year and the years beyond, if there are local organizers who would like to have the festival in their hometown, in their area of having been assaulted and continuing to be assaulted by the nuclear industry, as an organizing principle, as a consciousness raiser, as a PR piece, what do they need to do?
They just have to go to our website. You find the website if you Google Uranium Film Festival, and then send an email to us.
UraniumFilmFestival.org. And we will, of course, have that link up on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode. And for now, Norbert Sukhanek and Marcia Gomez de Oliveira, I want to wish you safe journey with deep gratitude for what you have done, and as always, for our affiliation with each other in and around Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Livy, and I'm looking forward to meet you again. I guess it will be in Los Angeles.
If not before.
Norbert Sukhanek, co-founder and director of the International Uranium Film Festival. We will, of course, keep you in the loop with the hope that the festival will be bringing Norbert and co-founder Marcia Gomez de Oliveira to Hollywood this November.
Activists, shout out.
It is with great sadness that we let you know that longtime activist Patty Amino has passed. She was a staunch anti-nuclear activist for decades and one of the earliest supporters of Nuclear Hot Seat. Patty grew up in Apollo, Pennsylvania, 35 miles northeast of Pittsburgh, not realizing that her childhood home was directly across the street from the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, or NUMEC. This company manufactured fuel for commercial nuclear power plants and the Navy's nuclear submarines, leaving behind a legacy of uranium and plutonium waste that impacted the health of everyone in the area, including, and most specifically, Patty. A trained investigator with Naval Intelligence Service and former U.S. federal criminal investigator, Patty took on NUMEC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Babcock and Wilcox, and Atlantic Richfield, and won. But the battle she was ultimately unable to win was her fight against illness and cancers that racked her body as a result of that early exposure to radioactive materials. For now, here's a very brief excerpt of our interview with her from Nuclear Hot Seat number 239, January 20th, 2016.
Well, every day above ground's a good day. I'm still vertical sucking air on my end, so I guess I'm okay. I still have another brain tumor. You know, I'm to the point now, because I've been through so much. I mean, I've had my head opened up twice for one brain tumor. I still have another brain tumor. I've had uterine cancer. Those are the things I attribute to being exposed by the industry. That's a side of physical problems I've dealt with when I was in the Navy. I'm basically with the mindset now that I don't even want to go to a doctor. I'm just ready to take whatever comes. But I don't want to hear any bad news, because I have enough to fight right now. Here's the one thing I've always believed. The truth may sometimes stand alone, but it always stands, and people will get behind it when they know it.
It is a sad truth that Patty Amino passed away on Friday, May 10, 2024. She was 71 years old. We will run our full interview with Patty from 2016 in the coming weeks. And on a lighter note, in Chicago, there is going to be a one-week festival of Godzilla versus Music Box at the Music Box Theater. The trailer for this is the funniest anti-nuclear piece I have seen, and we've got it posted on the website, NuclearHotSeat.com under this episode, number 673. If you're in Chicago or can get to Chicago, you can reserve tickets by going to MusicBoxTheater.com. That's theater with an R-E at the end. For the event, the Music Box is partnering with the Japanese Arts Foundation to throw Godzilla a birthday party. And among the speakers will be Dr. Yuki Miyamoto from DePaul University, who has been a guest many times here on Nuclear Hot Seat. Here's my favorite piece of Godzilla trivia. The original film was a metaphor for the horrors of nuclear war, done at a time when Japan was still under U.S. edict not to say, publish, or produce anything about the Japanese victims of the atom bombs. So instead of the bomb, all the blame for destruction and radiation contamination, as it was called, was placed on Godzilla, who was himself created by the bomb. The 1954 original film was co-written and directed by Ishiro Honda, who is from Fukushima. And if you can't get to Chicago for this wonderful event, we're going to have a link to the full 1954 original Japanese Godzilla movie, Gojira. It will be on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 673. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 14, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way to get it, and it's easy to sign up. Go to NuclearHotSeat.com and look for that yellow opt-in box. You really can't miss it. Put in your first name, an email address, and every week you will get one, count them, just one, email, which includes a link to that week's show and a brief description of some of the material that is in it. You can also sign up at any of your favorite podcast channel sites. But if you do it on the website, it goes into my database, it shows up on Google, and the algorithm likes me more every time another name gets signed there. So please, if you can, do it that way. Now, audience participation here. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Not Facebook, not any other way. Old-fashioned email. What can I say? I'm old. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all, and we will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, the names of any guests who you quote, and, if you can get around to it, include me there. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, question authority. We used to say that back in the 60s and 70s, and it's time to start saying it again. Question authority. All authority. But here, specifically, nuclear authority. And keep doing it. There you have it. You've just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because, hey, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.